Welcome to Berlin Inside Out, the podcast that takes an expert look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany, with me, Benjamin Tallis.
And me, Aaron Gash Burnett.
Hello and welcome back to Berlin Inside Out, the foreign affairs podcast in association with the German Council on Foreign Relations that takes an expert look at international politics from Berlin. I'm Aaron Gash Burnett, a journalist and security analyst specializing in German politics and foreign policy, and I'm here with my friend and co-host Benjamin Tallis, senior research fellow here at the Council and head of its action group, Zeitenwende. Now, Ben, we're recording this today, our second season finale of Berlin Inside Out, on the sidelines of the Leonard Mary Conference in Tallinn. And plenty of the conversations we've had here speak to the need for a new turning point in how we defend our democracies and ensure our prosperity. We've been hearing here, particularly from Estonian hosts, but also from others, and we agree that the road to doing that runs through Ukraine, specifically through Ukrainian victory. And I've noticed here in Tallinn calls for us to break the cycle of pessimism. And Prime Minister Kaja Kallas put it thus, we need to understand the situation is serious, but excessive pessimism can lead us into thinking that acting is pointless. So let's take bold steps to help Ukraine win and break that cycle. Let's up our military support and industrial capacity. Let's seize Russia's central bank assets. Let's give Ukraine a credible path to NATO. And I'm very happy to say, listeners, that we were at a media briefing with Prime Minister Kaja Kallas, and we will be hearing excerpts of what she told international media, including us, at the briefing later on in the show. But Ben, in contrast to the we'll find a way or make one approach that we see in Tallinn, in other capitals, in Germany, we often hear about why we can't do any of these things, often for reasons that frankly just don't stack up. And that seems a far cry from Chancellor Olaf Scholz's Zeitenwende speech 2 years ago, in which he promised a new era in German and foreign and security policy. So have we really had a Zeitenwende, and is that term still useful?
No and no. On the substance, I stand by the assessment that we made at the end of last year, based on the work of the action group Zeitenwende, that the change, Germany's sea change or turning point, as trailed by Olaf Scholz in that speech, is not only seriously incomplete on its own terms, but it's dangerously inadequate to meet the challenges that we actually face and seize the opportunities that we'll need to in order to not despair, but actually act, as is the theme of this conference here. In terms of the speed of change, the level of ambition of that change, and how internationally coordinated it's been, and the coherence it has across policy sectors, it hasn't met the moment. It hasn't met the requirements. The one exception, I would say, is the sustainability of the change that's been made, which is likely to stick, but that's also because it hasn't gone very far, to be quite honest. Even though in some areas, such as relations to Russia, I'm not sure the current position will actually be sustained if there's a geopolitical shift again. That assessment also goes for the five major fields that were covered in the speech. Support for Ukraine as the first, building Germany's defense capabilities second, third, the approach to authoritarian states, fourth, Germany's contribution to and positioning in key institutions, EU and NATO especially, and fifth, and lastly, its energy mix. And while Germany has got off Russian gas, and it did so fast, partly because Russia turned off the tap, it hasn't yet found an energy mix that answers geopolitical as well as ecological and economic considerations that is sustainable in the long run. But this is where I'd shift to the positive. The Zeitenwende has succeeded in opening up the space of discussion in which geopolitical considerations, security considerations in fields of energy and economy, as well as others, can actually be discussed. However, going with the latest research we've been doing, including via a series of focus groups that we commissioned around Germany and which was just presented to the action group Zeitenwende this week, I think the term has now outlived its usefulness because it's seen by experts and the general public alike as empty, and has become something of a symbol of inadequacy rather than of rising to meet the geopolitical moment, let alone setting the kind of strategy we need to face the future with confidence. But that's in Germany. Elsewhere, it has been different, and some didn't need to change so much in the first place. Others have recognized mistakes of the past and have changed position rhetorically, at least, even if questions remain about the material backup to that and how sustainable that change will be. And that's what we want to talk about with our guests today.
Exactly so. So to help us discuss both the German and European dimensions of this, including how to bring about the strategic turning point we need to see, We're joined by a fabulously international panel, which we hope will help you understand the multiple perspectives in play here. So first up, welcome to Benjamin Haddad, a member of the French National Assembly and self-described recovering think tanker, as I heard you say yesterday, having had quite the career in security studies before heading into politics. Welcome also to Ambassador Jonathan Sevjov, the Secretary General of the Estonian Foreign Affairs Ministry. And finally, Dr. Sabina Fischer, Senior Fellow in the Research Division on Eastern Europe and Eurasia at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs. So we're going to give our hosts the privilege of going first. Jonathan, we're talking about how the security debate has changed or needs to change in Europe or parts of Europe, but Estonia hasn't had the same turning point, partly because it warned about Russian intentions, the weaponization of Nord Stream 2, and it ended up being right. How does it feel to have been proven right? And what are the changes Germany and others need to make to catch up? But also, we must also ask this, what changes do you think Estonia might also need to make?
So first of all, thank you for having me, and thank you for the kind words. It's great to be here in Tallinn at the Limit-Mary Conference. I think the conference year after year becomes more and more relevant. I think it doesn't feel particularly great to have been right. We always knew we were right. I'm sure our opponents back in the day in those debates also thought they were right. And then when they realized they weren't, they did the gracious thing of saying that they were mistaken and changed course. That's not relevant to today because we're in the middle of a war that will shape Europe's history, Europe's future, certainly Estonia's security. And instead of focusing on who was right, who was wrong a year ago or 10 years ago, we should be focusing on the future. What it is that we're trying to get out of this, how do we define victory, which shouldn't really be a controversial issue, and it hasn't been for Estonia. We've said it publicly, officially. We define victory as an outcome that safeguards territorial integrity and sovereignty as cornerstones of European security, and that obviously also includes territorial integrity and sovereignty for Ukraine. Our definition of victory includes the notion that aggression as a tool of statecraft should be discredited, meaning that the aggressor should not find himself in a better position strategically or politically or economically than he was when he decided to commit aggression. It relates to this notion of accountability, both with regard to war crimes and the crime of aggression, but also to accountability in the sense of the damages that have been caused in Ukraine and potential reparations, or if not those, then the use of frozen assets for the reconstruction of Ukraine. And it includes the notion of Europe that's security architecture remains standing on the 2 feet it's been standing on, that's NATO and the European Union, with those that are willing and able as part of those organizations. And that obviously includes Ukraine and Moldova and others, with the caveat of them meeting the necessary requirements. These are merit-based organizations. But we should be very, very open and clear about the fact that war, instability, chaos in post-Cold War Europe has always stemmed from those so-called gray areas. And if we leave a gray area in the middle of the geostrategic center of Europe, then we'll have nothing but war, chaos, and instability in the future. So that's what we're focused on, talking about it openly, pushing for others to do more, pushing ourselves to do more. The only metric that matters is not whether we were right yesterday, whether we are right today. The only metric that matters is whether we win or whether we lose. And we won't know until it happens. Now, I don't want to go on for too long, but I'll just say one more thing. You know, we're democracies. We're very good at creating narratives, talking about stuff. So it's only natural that when we win wars, we celebrate them with concrete dates in mind. When we lose wars, we tend to do a very good job at explaining the loss away. Sooner or later, the defeat becomes evident. We lost the war in Afghanistan. Taliban is back. We lost it. But when did we lose it? My point being here that our defeats, unless they're total defeats, which are unlikely at this stage, our defeats usually come under other banners. They come under the banner of peace or of strategic stability. That's why we're advocating for very clear language when it comes to what we're trying to get out of this current war. We're somewhat concerned that others find it difficult to use similarly a clear language, because it obviously raises all sorts of logical questions as to why. There are certainly no intellectual gaps or holdbacks. And final thing I want to say before handing it over to colleagues on Germany, I can sense how the criticism that comes from this part of Europe towards Germany, how it can irritate our German friends for good reasons. Who likes to be criticized? And I'm not saying this as a government official, but just as an observer. When you look at the criticism coming from, you know, Polish think tanks or Lithuania or Latvia or Estonia, look at the essence of the criticism. It is those countries, those societies demanding for more Germany, more German military might, more German economic presence, more Germany. And I know it can be irritating, but if you take a few steps back and look at the context, look at who's talking and consider their history, there cannot be a greater compliment to Germany's democracy and trustworthiness, that you have Poland demanding for more Germany or Lithuania demanding for more Germany. So I hope that our German friends, even when they disagree, see this as the most significant of compliments that Germany could get from countries that, frankly, 60, 70, 80 years ago were in a, how to put it mildly, a fundamentally different position.
That's right, and that's been a consistent theme of Berlinside Out. We want the best Germany we can get, and part of that involves identifying the problems, the criticisms need to be made, but also creating solutions. Now, Benjamin, over to you. It's been said that there has been a French Zeitenwende, the Bratislava agenda, as it's been laid out. Could you talk us through the reasons behind that, what it constitutes, and also how sustainable it is? Because there have also been criticisms that it's a lot of talk, not backed up by rhetoric. So how do you see France's change?
Let me pick up on one point that Jonathan just made, because I think it's really critical. Your question is, the Zeitenwende, European Zeitenwende, real? And of course, the jury is still out, because it will depend on whether we win this war or not. Vladimir Putin's first hope was to take over Kyiv very quickly in a couple of weeks, that Ukraine would fall apart, and that, of course, allies wouldn't react. And what we've seen so far is that allies have stayed united, that Europeans have dramatically increased their defense spending in Germany and France, elsewhere, sent weapons to Ukraine, and that we're still focused and we're still discussing today how to increase both the quantity but also the nature of our military support for Ukraine. But of course, Putin's gambit, and this is why I was troubled a few months into the war when I started seeing France that, I think we're doing this for the right reasons, but started writing that Putin had already lost, because he'd lost Ukraine strategically, because Sweden and Finland were about to join NATO, because we were united, because NATO had found a purpose again. And, you know, as much as I appreciated the optimism, this is a long game. This, unfortunately, you know, there's no quick fix to this. And the biggest test is whether we're able to sustain our support and sustain our own effort to arm ourselves at the same time. And this is where we're going to be tested. We'll discuss this in more detail. Let me talk about the French Zeitenwende, as I think The Economist has called it. Look, one thing hasn't changed is that since 2017, and I would say even before, but clearly President Macron, more than his predecessors, has put that as the center of his agenda, we're pushing a vision that Europe could be wiped out of history, that Europe could become sort of a passive theater of great power rivalry with no agency over its technological, military, economic, energetic future, and that it needs to take ownership of its own security, and be able to, without naivete, defend its own security interests, trade interests, protect itself maybe from dangerous foreign investment in its infrastructure and technology, and so forth. The test for our ability to promote this agenda is our support for Ukraine, and is our ability to integrate the security imperatives and the threats, not only, I would say, of our partners like Estonia, Poland, and others, but also to recognize the fact that Russia is targeting us. Not only is targeting the European security architecture, and is putting this as clearly dismantling the security architecture as one of his key priorities, but is targeting France directly. Constant cyber attacks against our infrastructure, hospitals, key ministries, interference in our democracy, which started, by the way, I mean, at the very beginning of Macron's campaign in 2017, the hacking of his emails, propaganda, going after our interests in Africa with Wagner, with propaganda operations. And so recognizing that. You mentioned the Bratislava speech. I do think it was a historic speech for a couple of reasons. I mean, of course, there was the tone, recognizing at the beginning of the speech that, you know, alluding to Jacques Chirac's famous sentence in 2003 that the new members in Central Europe had lost and wasted an opportunity to shut up. He said, "We wasted an opportunity to listen to you." Now, you know, if you allow me to maybe take a second on this comment, it's interesting because when I started traveling to Warsaw, for example, on a regular basis, especially when I was working in think tanks, I would hear this reference all the time, the Chirac sentence. And I would go back to France and tell them, you know, I mean, they still care very much about this. And people would tell me, well, yeah, but Chirac was right because he was right about Iraq. And it was interesting. I said, well, but that's not the point. The point is you have countries that have, after half a century of occupation, were abandoned behind the Iron Curtain, that have recovered their sovereignty, their freedom 15 years ago, and now you're telling them to shut up. And the point I'm trying to make is there was for a long time in Paris a lack of sensitivity, historical empathy, geographical empathy towards the region, and I would say just lack of curiosity, not enough engagement. I would go to think tanking events such as this one, and I would very often be the only French person. And I was invited because I was part of an American organization. And I think that has changed. Now you see all across the region, parliamentarians, diplomats, think tank experts trying to engage. There is no agenda for European sovereignty or strategic autonomy, however you want to call it. I don't have any theological opinions about the terms, without pushing back against Russian aggression, without making the case especially to this region, but to all of Europe, that Europe can protect themselves against Russian aggression. That was, I think, the key point of the Bratislava speech.
Absolutely. And just to remember that comment came in the same year that there was a famous letter, an open letter. Germany loves open letters, as we know. But this was from Jürgen Habermas and Jacques Derrida that actually referred to a core Europe and a non-core Europe. And that comment from Chirac played into exactly that idea that there was a hierarchy within Europe. Despite the formal equality that we were going to see through NATO and EU membership, there were still some true Europeans and those who were lucky to be there on tolerance from the others. And addressing that grievance has been so important in actually understanding what that French Titan vendor might be. And so bringing Central and Eastern Europe into that perspective, and we'll come more onto that later. But Sabina, we'd like to come over to you.
Reflecting on all of this, we've heard Ben just talk about this perception of old Europe versus new Europe. That has also been a perception that Germany has, in to varying degrees, also had or been criticized for having. How would you assess this from a German perspective? And what is the need for further change within Germany? And do we need more? You know, as much as Germany is obviously listening more to North and Central and Eastern Europe, I would also argue that there's more that could be done. What would you say to this?
Yeah, I mean, I can start by saying that we definitely need more. And I've been saying that also publicly in Germany for the past 2 years. So I agree with the criticism of sort of the Zeitenwende policy getting stuck on various issues and aspects of it. And that's a problem. Nevertheless, I would actually like to stress that there have been changes, very, very profound changes in the German perception of the whole region, really. I mean, there is a lot more humbleness with regard to the positions and also the warnings that were given by Poland, by the Baltic states with regard to Russia's imperialism, right? And Russia's aggressive policies. I think the German perception of not of Central Eastern Europe, so basically the partners in the European Union and NATO, but indeed of Eastern Europe has changed profoundly. So, I mean, and this is in a way really tragic because until February 2022, the mainstream, let's say, German perspective of Eastern Europe was very, very much focused on Russia. So there was this Russia prism, and the political community in Berlin looked at the other countries in the region through this prism. And it required the full-scale invasion to finally put Ukraine and Moldova and Georgia and the other countries on the mental map in Germany. And I think they are there to stay. But this is, of course, something that I, as a German, have to say that it started to change slowly after 2014. So there was a process before the beginning of the full-scale invasion. But of course, it was much too slow. So this is where we are. With regard to the criticism, I think it's very important to have a nuanced and granulated picture of Germany's policies and the politics behind them, because we are in a difficult domestic situation. I think the Zeitenwende and the changes in the thinking that made the Zeitenwende possible, they're there to stay with regard to the democratic parties. And it's already said that I have to say this, the democratic parties, because we have less democratic parties now on the political fringes of the political spectrum. And here we have very different positions and also strategic visions with regard to Russia, Ukraine, the whole region and the war. And we have very important elections coming up. And some of the democratic parties are under very serious pressure. So this is a tension that will impact on Germany's policies in the coming months and years. And it worries me. I wanted to make one point in reaction to what you said, Johnson, about narratives, because, I was a little bit surprised when you said that democracies are actually very good at producing narratives, because my impression also with regard to my own position within the German discourse, for instance, but also when we look at the global debate, specifically about the war against Ukraine, but also then Gaza, etc., is that we're really not good at narratives, and that Russia is actually, I'm not saying it's already winning the war of narratives, but we're moving in this direction. And this is, I think, it's a really great danger for Ukraine. It's very existential, but also for our democracies.
Look, I guess I have to jump back in and say that I don't necessarily disagree with you. The point I was trying to make is that democratic governments are in power because they have been able to explain to their people what they're trying to do, create some sort of a narrative. And it's tested every few years, whether they can explain it away, whether they cannot. There isn't much else that keeps a democratic government in power but their ability to create a narrative. This is not necessarily the case in foreign policy. But there, the limitation isn't our ability. It's our willingness. And that's the reason why we should be concerned. When we don't make sense, and I'm talking about we, not Estonia, not Germany, or any particular country, this is a hypothetical. If our narrative doesn't make sense in the wider world, if we're using talking points that clearly are superficial or hollow, then the limitation usually is not our ability. It's something else. And that we should openly call out, talk about, perhaps not openly in the general public, because everybody's domestic political situation is difficult. Every few years, our American friends come here and tell us about how difficult it is and how the voter in Wisconsin doesn't necessarily vote because of his or her foreign policy positions and doesn't necessarily understand why the transatlantic relationship is of importance and how we need to all take this into consideration, to which I always like to reply, well, listen, the voter in Hamburg doesn't necessarily care about these things either. And because I can't speak on behalf of Germany, let me then speak on behalf of Estonia. Well, the voter in Tartu doesn't necessarily vote because of his or her foreign policy ideals either. So sometimes we need to have those open discussions behind closed doors, and that's not actually impossible to do. When we don't have those discussions, whether we want it or not, ends up undermining trust, and that's dangerous.
Right, and this is something we've seen. It's often said that Germany's current problem is a communication problem. I think it's not only a communication problem, there's a substance issue as well, but there is also a communication problem here, that the Scholz administration in particular has not been willing to outline the kind of clarity of vision that we've heard from all of you today, that actually victory is what is needed. And Jonathan, you mentioned before, we're very good at dressing up defeat in other language, and I think we're pre-dressing it here in terms of restraint, prudence, Besonnenheit. These watchwords for the German government at the moment, which don't understand that actually we need to be going for that victory.
Well, the logical question that comes to anyone's mind when the person listens to a government tiptoeing around the definition of victory, the logical question is whether or not the tiptoeing is that particular government attempting to keep the back door open. It's not really wise communicative policy, because you can't hide it indefinitely. I mean, sooner or later it comes an inflection point when you have to take a stand, go left or go right. But our inability to use clear language is not driven by our limitations when it comes to articulation as such. It's driven by something else. And smart people know this. And the people in the Kremlin are smart. So I'm not worried necessarily what this does to the cohesion of the West or of Europe. It does undermine trust, because it raises those questions. And you ask those questions, and sometimes those questions end up being insulting, because they're maybe that's not the case. Maybe it's something domestic political. Who knows? The main worry is that in addition to fully being on board with what President Macron suggested, which is strategic ambiguity with regard to certain issues, there should be some areas where we should have strategic clarity. Exactly. And we seem to be lacking that. And that's a problem, because it communicates to the Russians that Putin's only remaining argument in his theory of victory, which is that time is on his side. And by the way, this is a very short-term proposition. It's not like some other, you know, the Chinese think in centuries. This Putin argument, they count in weeks and months. Time is on my side. Everything else is lost. He clearly isn't making Russia great again. He clearly isn't unifying the Russian world. His troops clearly weren't welcomed with flowers. But time is on his side. When we communicate in ways that hint at us keeping the door open to some sort of a walkout, then unfortunately that reinforces Putin arguments in the discussions that really matter. And those discussions take place somewhere in the suburbs of Moscow, where people get together amongst close friends, the people who keep Putin and his policies around. We shouldn't be communicating strategic ambiguity in all areas of our policy.
No, 100%. There should be clarity of vision backed up with ambiguity about how we're going to achieve it to keep them on the back foot. That's clear. You mentioned before you can't speak for the voter in Hamburg. Well, thankfully we can, slightly after these focus groups that we've just commissioned, and for voters in Magdeburg and elsewhere around Germany, where we conducted a series of these focus groups. And one of the clear things that came out of that is a lack of understanding about this clarity of vision and clarity of message, and a feeling that comes from it that voters are not being well represented and they're not being well managed and governed, actually, that there's a lack of leadership and a lack of ability to rise to the challenges which they very clearly care about. And this was clearly geopolitical and geoeconomic challenges people do feel impact their lives, but they don't feel they're being served a political offer that actually credibly manages that. And so the encouraging part of this, of course, is there's scope for political actors who want to move into that space and who could actually communicate and come up with a credible vision.
Jonathan, I'm struck. You said sort of defeats are hard to kind of understand because we can explain it away over time, and then it's difficult for us to figure out exactly when it happened. You also said that victory is easy to commemorate, but I would also say that victory seems to be, at least in this case, hard to define, or that we, you know, are having all kinds of disagreements about precisely how we define victory, particularly in Ukraine. So that's why I want to come to you, Benjamin, on this, because of a panel that you were on here at Leonard Mary. We talked in our Pillars is a victory episode on Berlin Side Out about what Ukrainian victory means and how you achieve it, you said that integrating Ukraine into NATO should be considered a key part of the definition of Ukrainian victory. Yet we're not expecting an invite to Ukraine at the upcoming Washington summit. So why does it seem to be so hard to really figure out, you know, this diplomatic part of Ukrainian victory between allies? Is there some nervousness about what kind of reordering effects a victory in Ukraine might have?
It's clear to me that the definition of victory can not only be territorial. Putin has not lost hundreds of thousands of people just to gain control of a few towns in Donbass. This is about first dismantling the European security architecture, and it's about wiping out Ukraine as a sovereign nation, as and its ability to choose freely and democratically its future and its Western orientation. This started, we all know it, in 2014 in Maidan, the day that European kids were getting shot at for the European flag because they saw it as the inspiration for a better future. And this is what Putin saw as a threat, a counter-model, a democratic model at his borders. And we couldn't see this. We didn't support it in 2014. And I think we rose to a certain extent to the event in 2022. So, of course, this is part of this. And it's the only way to ensure also the long-term stability and deterrence in the region. We made a mistake when we closed the door to Georgia and Ukraine in 2008, thinking that sending them an invitation to NATO would provoke Russia, when it was exactly the other way around. It provoked the aggression and it invited Russia to attack to see that they were not being defended. Now, there's no agreement today. This is something, by the way, that if we're talking about the French Zeitung vendor, that French clearly changed position on. It was with Germany in 2008 in Bucharest and closing the door to Ukraine. And there's a sense in Paris that not only is it what Ukrainians are fighting for, but this is also, if you look at the other options, people talk the Israeli option. Israel has nuclear weapons. People talk about the South Korean option. There's close to 100,000 American troops there. The only way to ensure long-term stability and deterrence is to have robust security guarantees that passes through NATO. Now, I think today the United States and Germany consider that this would send the wrong message during the war. And of course, it's not about having Ukraine join NATO during the war, but at least send an invitation for after, a clear signal. Once again, as Jonathan said, to Putin, that we're in the long run, that time is not playing in his favor. But there's still the debate about this. And I wish we'd go further. And maybe just a point on Germany, because I really don't want to underestimate what's going on in Germany. I mean, if you look at the dramatic increase in defense spending, if you look at what Germany is doing in terms of weapons delivery for Ukraine, and even the change in intellectual software that I see from the German intellectual and political elite, I don't think it should be underestimated. If you're an external actor, France is a very presidential system where the president pushes a button and the whole system follows. And of course, we see Germany and you have the chancellor who tells you, well, I have a different coalition parties, and then there's the Bundestag and there's the Länder. So it's a very different system. The one thing on which I think it's still frustrating for us is I find that Germany has a much harder time overcoming certain taboos without the United States. You know, we went to long-range missiles with the Brits without getting permission from whoever. Same thing for the tanks. We had a debate on Ukraine's NATO, and the president said we need to support Ukraine's accession into NATO. And I think these are still things for the Germans. It's complicated to go there without the United States.
Just to back up to the Bratislava speech just a second, and the Ukraine's NATO membership and its support from France, this was a key signal in terms of actually giving credibility to that shift. And this is what I actually asked President Macron to do at Globsec last year, to say, look, it's all very well and good saying we're now listening to Central Eastern Europe. You're going to need some concrete steps to back that up. So how about actually supporting Ukraine's NATO membership as one? And credit to him, actually, he then went and did that. And it was great to see that brought a lot of credibility. But you're right, that's not aligned yet with the German position, nor with the US position. Although, to make it clear, and Sabina, we'll come to you on this in just a moment, what's good for the US is not necessarily good for Germany, because we are much more drastically and directly exposed to the threats that would come from not getting Ukraine right than the Americans are. So what's holding Germany back on this?
I think what you just described, Benjamin, is it's really a difference in strategic culture between France and Germany. And it also has a lot to do with Germany's post-war history. So this is really about political traditions, and it's very difficult to leave them behind. I mean, and the whole discussion about strategic autonomy and Germany's hesitations with regard to strategic autonomy, because there is such a strong focus on transatlantic relations, that is one of the big differences between Germany and France. And I mean, I think we all know that the Franco-German tandem, I mean, there have been some bumps in the road, including because of this over the past few years. I don't see this changing fundamentally. I mean, the German attitude, or the attitude of the German government, with this government. There is a lot of concern and also fear with regard to the upcoming presidential election in the US. I don't really see a plan B in Berlin right now, which may have to do with the fact that, and this brings us back a little bit to what we discussed at the beginning, with the fact that even though there have been profound changes in political thinking about Russia, about the region, about European security in more general terms, the political approach, and I appreciate all the good words you said about what has been done, in fact, because I agree, you know, defense spending, it is really unprecedented. So German policymakers are right when they point out that what has been done since February 2022 was absolutely unthinkable, really, literally, until the 23rd of February 2022. So this is true. But still, when it comes to the implementation of Zeitenwende, the approach is, let's say, it's technocratic, it's also bureaucratic, and it is less strategic than it should be. I wanted to say one tiny thing about communication. Just wanted to point out that I don't think the whole government has a communication problem. I mean, there are people in the government who have a very clear language about sure. About the war.
Robert Habeck, for example, has been widely celebrated
Boris
for
Pistorius, his Boris who is Pistorius, so the Minister of Defense. Right. I mean, we have and he's a Social Democrat, and he's very outspoken, both about the the outcome of the war that would be in Germany's interest, but also about German security policy itself. You know, I mean, he's the one who threw the term Kriegstüchtigkeit, how would you translate that?
War readiness
into the German debate.
See, listeners, my German's improving.
Congratulations, I'm very happy to hear it. So it really has to do with this government. It's a difficult constellation, you know, with these three parties who do not necessarily see eye to eye. But with Boris Pistorius taking his position, you also see that there is an internal debate in the Social Democratic Party.
You do. And also, Pistorius's reward for that clear communication has been to be consistently rated the most popular politician in Germany. So again, there would be a lesson here if we were willing to learn it.
What we also have to be aware of is that I think there are different necessities when it comes to talking about the war in different European societies. I mean, I think it was the Estonian defense minister who said yesterday, we should not talk about a potential Ukrainian defeat, because this is basically, it's just depressing and it's discouraging. We are discouraging the Ukrainians and ourselves. I think in Germany, it's exactly the other way around. I think in Germany, we have to talk about the potential knock-on effects of a Ukrainian defeat in order to make it clear to people what the stakes are, really, because I think many people still don't understand
that. That's right, and that's what we've been trying to do also with some of our publications, with some of the clear language that's been coming out of the action group Zeitenwende. And to be fair, some German politicians have communicated this very clearly. Roderick Kiesewetter, Norbert Röttgen, also a lot of the Greens and some from the FDP too. But Jonathan, I want to come to you on this, because you, in your TED talk and also what you mentioned earlier, the only metric that matters is winning. And while we might give credit to Germany for what's been done, pointing to what we've done doesn't really get us to what we need to do.
Absolutely. And before going into that question, sure, I just want to aggressively agree. We have to make it absolutely clear what the stakes are. We're human beings in democracies. We're not going to take the hard steps unless we understand that the alternative to those steps is even worse. That's the only thing that can make us move. So why not talk openly about the stakes? Let's not be afraid of the truth. And the only metric that matters indeed is whether or not we win. The outcome is what matters.
Can I link those two things just very briefly? Because this also came up on our discussion with Tim Snyder and Elliot Cohen and Marcus Tarkner yesterday. The slogan of this conference, let us not despair, but act. Indeed, let us not despair, but we have to be absolutely clear-eyed about the threats that we face. It's what we're going to do with them that actually matters, that changes the difference from fear as paralysis into fear as driver for credible action.
So we have to know what the stakes are. We have to know what our goals are. And then we have to focus on those goals. And then the debate could revolve around the issues of what is to be done. And there are obviously dilemmas involved. I'm not going to argue that some of the concerns that some nations have are somehow lacking in legitimacy. But let's have those debates then. But when it comes to the stakes, when it comes to our shared goals, without those, we can't really expect to pull this off. I sometimes listen to our European and Western leaders get agitated on the point that, look, but we've done so much. And agitated at, for instance, the Ukrainians when they're critical still. Because obviously we've done a lot and we've made major changes. And Germany has done so and France has done so. Frankly, Estonia has done so. And it hasn't been easy, obviously. But look at the wider picture. We have a house that's on fire. An active arsonist is not only pouring gasoline, but setting fire to additional rooms. People are dying in the house. And now we've showed up with the fire trucks. Some arrived an hour late. Some arrived a year late. Some of the water misses the target. Some of it is useful. But the house is still on fire. And now the fire brigades around the building are telling the families in the house that, look, don't be critical of us. We showed up. They want to survive this. And for as long as the war is ongoing, we haven't really achieved what we're supposed to achieve. So all of this talk on how, you know, well we've done, I fully agree with Ben. We shouldn't be congratulating ourselves for a victory that we have yet to achieve. All of this is nothing but waste of time. We need to focus. And the same, by the way, applies to the question of, are we Estonians happy now that the others have recognized that we were right 5 years ago? We don't care. We don't care. We'll deal with this in the future. We'll have a seminar. We'll get historians together. It's going to be fun. We'll share war stories. Today, the focus should be on the future and only on the future.
Sabine, I'm struck actually by something you said, which relates exactly to what Jonathan just said. We have a division between those who think that the consequences of a Ukrainian defeat can be contained and those who don't think that it could be contained. So the house on fire analogy here is very, very apt. It got me to what you said yesterday. Who are those? You know, is that fair? And also, that really seems to fly into, you know, we remember Rolf Mutzenich in Germany saying that we should freeze the conflict, for example, this idea that you could contain this. Now, that seems to fly in the face of what we hear from our Nordic and Baltic friends who say that their expectations, despite all of this talk in Germany, are still really high.
And it also contradicts what's been said in Paris very clearly, too. It rather puts Germany and those others who don't see the potential spillover out on a limb, doesn't it?
Well, I was very unhappy with this statement by Rolf Mutzenich. I mean, I hated the term frozen conflict before February 2022. I hate it even more now. And I've been fighting against it for the past, I don't know, 10, 15 years, because I've done a lot of work on unresolved conflicts in the EU's eastern neighborhood. And I think it's just totally, completely inappropriate as a term. So I was very unhappy also because I think... the whole idea of, I mean, I think it's just completely impossible to freeze this war. It's not possible. And especially not in the current situation and along the current front line. So also strategically and tactically, it's just very stupid. On the containing or on the question of whether or not the war and its implications are containable, I think you find... people who think it is contained, they are containable, it is containable, not only in Germany, in different parties, but you also find them in the United States, for instance, you know. So the difference is between those who think that the effects of a Russian victory on Europe and also the global order would be so comprehensive, negative, that basically it would put the rules-based international order at risk. And then there are those who believe that it is possible actually to contain the effects so that they don't destabilize the European and the rules-based international order. So it is important to not to become too involved in Europe, to contain the war and the conflict to Ukraine, in order to be able to invest more capacities in Asia. So these are two very different strategic outlooks, but you have these positions in both political communities. And you could also add that, of course, the Russia's war against Ukraine and its outcome are part of the systemic rivalry, and China is watching this very closely. I want to speak about the idea that it's possible to contain the war with regard to Germany and the US. And I mean, you find people in Germany and the US who think that, but for different reasons. So I think in Germany, the idea speaks to a longing for peace in significant segments of German society.
And there's really been a change in language on this in Paris, Ben, quite clearly. I mean, President Macron's rhetorical move to, first of all, say Russia's defeat is necessary as well as Ukraine's victory, to not rule out putting ground troops into Ukraine, actually, to get this strategic ambiguity in service of that, has shown that that's been a switch that's been made in Paris. But how credible is that beyond the rhetoric?
I think it's very credible. I mean, there's a sense that, first, Russia's victory would be a catastrophic defeat for Europe. I mean, that it's all of the EU's existence that's at stake, that we would have a Russia that would be at the border of the Baltic states, Romania, Poland, and more aggressive than ever. And especially in the context of the questions arising from the United States with the election and maybe the question on the US security guarantees down the road. And on the strategic ambiguity, I mean, there's a sense that we've been self-censoring, negotiating with ourselves for the last 2 years, constantly signaling to the adversary our own limits and red lines, where we have an adversary, Russia, that has put no such red line either on its rhetoric or on its action. And so you have to turn it around and maybe give him something to think about. Now, when it comes to being backed by substance, I mean, look, if you look at the last ranking, the Kiel ranking, that takes into account the support for multilateral institutions like the European Peace Facility and everything that other countries use to refinance their support for Ukraine, France is ranked third behind the United States and Germany. Now, of course, if you take per GDP or, you know, countries like Estonia are way above us. If the question is, and by the way, and these rankings don't take into account the quality of the weapons, like a Caesar cannon is not very expensive, but will be very effective on the ground. If the question is, should we do more? I think we should all do more. We should all do more in quantity. We should be very creative about how we find resources also to sustain our support. I'm very supportive of the Estonian idea that pushed forward by Prime Minister Kallas to have defense Eurobonds, 100 billion on the table. We consider that COVID was an existential crisis and we created common debt. Well, I do think that's existential as well. So let's create common debt. I introduced a resolution in French Parliament to confiscate Russian frozen assets, not only the windfall profits, but I think we have to build the legal framework to go after the capital. The aggressor should pay for the reparation and the support for Ukraine. So let's think about, you know, there's no quick fix to this. We're in the long haul. So let's think about how we can sustain our support in the long haul.
Right. And it's understanding what those different pillars of victory actually are, the financial and economic, as well as the military, and putting it together with the diplomatic that gives us the strategic position and strategic means to actually go forward, which is what we covered on our Pillars of Victory multiple episode with some wonderful guests that you can listen into. There's another link to that in the show notes, of course. But I want to come to this point on coherence more widely, because Sabina, you mentioned before that Berlin is in lockstep with Washington on its position for Ukraine. But we can all see Berlin is not in lockstep with Washington when it comes to China or on geoeconomics more widely. And I think this for me at least points to what the real Titan vendor would actually be, which is a clear strategic approach. And we've mentioned different strategic cultures. But Ben, I want to come back to you first on this, because you talked about strategic autonomy and so on. And we could disagree whether that's autonomy from the US or it's more strategic agency for Europe, which I think is a more compelling way to put it, certainly to Berlin. But it needs a strategy. And every time Macron has put something forward on this, he's been waiting for a response from Berlin, and it frankly hasn't come.
There was a lot of frustration in Paris after the 2017 Sorbonne speech, where he did lay out ambitious visions for sovereignty and agency. And we felt there was no response from Berlin. Now, we did move forward, did a lot of things. I mean, at the end of the day, the relationship with Chancellor Merkel did give us the bonds on COVID, the recovery package, which is 800 billion euros. But there's a lot more to do, as you talked about geoeconomics. I mean, it is also the end of a certain naivete that trade necessarily leads to the pacification of relations. I mean, we've seen on the contrary that energy was used as a weapon by Russia as leverage over our democracies. And we're going to find the same situation probably tomorrow with China. So the question is not to cut ourselves from trade, of course not, but it's to protect ourselves, to protect our industrial interests, to screen investments. And we've let 10 years ago China buy a harbor in Athens. I mean, so it
and now
is
a good stake at the port in Hamburg.
Yeah, absolutely, which was criticized by France, by the way. So it is about, you know, giving ourselves the tools to be able to defend ourselves in this respect. But you know, I don't want to be too defensive about it because we were talking about it yesterday. It is also about making Europe a competitive, innovative continent. I mean, we've lost 20 to 25 points of GDP from the United States since 2008 because the U.S. has invested massively in its economic recovery, in its green and industry, in its tech industry, because it has extraordinarily competitive university campuses, et cetera, et cetera.
So, and the capital market system that actually works to move
course,
from startup to scale up.
An integrated capital market, of course.
Right. Now, it's often said that we do need more leadership and we need more strategy in Europe. I've just said it. But Jonathan, you're too modest to say it, I'm sure. But we've got that leadership coming from the Baltic states, haven't we? I mean, your Frit for Freedom agenda is the bones of this kind of strategy we need, isn't it?
Depends on how you want to define leadership. If leadership is just being ambitious and clear in our messages, then I'm very happy to take the compliment.
But true, but
true leadership really depends on whether or not others will follow. And on some points, we've been able to do, demonstrate leadership. In other cases, we haven't been. So it depends. Depends on whether or not we actually can get others to follow. The way it usually works is not by others following you, but by others taking your ideas on board and making those ideas their own. So a good leader, the fact that you're a leader is only evident during the phase where your leadership really is in question. By the time your leadership is solidified, those are no longer your ideas. They then become everyone's ideas. So there's a bit of a tragic note in that sort of leadership. But there's one more point I want to underline. Leadership or demonstrated successful leadership is only heroic from the benefit of the hindsight. By definition, a leader has to put him or herself ahead of the pack. That means alone. And at a moment before others join and take those ideas and make them their own, the leader is alone. That runs counter to every part of our foreign policy DNA. Never alone again is part of our DNA. So it's not an easy ride. It takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of willingness to take risks. We'd rather not do it, to be honest with you. The only reason why we ever put ourselves out there, expose ourselves in a position where we're by definition alone, is because we understand what the stakes are, and we understand that the risk of not doing so is far greater than the risk of sometimes putting ourselves out there and being alone. But I don't want to leave the people with an impression that this is all heroic, simple stuff. It is hard. It's risky. It's rather terrible, I should say. I'd rather not do it.
Right, and this is it. Leadership is a responsibility. It's a serious responsibility. Some take leadership and they get glory, but you rarely take real leadership to get the glory, if it's true leadership.
Victories have several fathers. Defeats are orphans.
Orphans,
we know
indeed,
that.
Yes.
And again, I want to underline this. You can only lead others when they buy into the idea that you represent.
But that also requires...
And then that idea becomes theirs. It becomes theirs. Great leaders in history, I mean, we talk about them as historical figures, but they were great because they were able to not just have people follow them as individuals, but have people follow that idea, the Churchills of the past. And then the idea is shared by others. So you don't get to be heroic as an individual for long. People take your idea on board, and you're only successful if you manage to do that.
But that requires them to recognize what's going on. And
yes,
this point we made about understanding Central and Eastern Europe, listening to those and understanding where leadership is actually coming from, Sabina, would surely be a step to the truth site inventor that not only Germany but Europe needs, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we talked about German leadership earlier in our discussion. I think it is very important at the same time for me, and this is really, you know, against the background of German history in the 20th century, to me, the embeddedness of German policy within the European framework is also extremely important. So one is possible only in combination with the other. And yeah, this is the way I want to see German policy evolve. I mean, it's a very abstract idea of peace. Again, it has a lot to do with German history in the 20th century and some other factors, but this is very important. And the idea that it's possible to contain the war and the conflict more or less to Ukraine so that it doesn't affect Germany and the European Union is very important in that respect. And I think, you know, what we see now in certain corners of the German political debate, also with the, after the beginning of the election campaign, has to do with that. In the US, it's different. In the US, I think this position is underpinned by the global strategic vision. And the US, I mean, these are people who argue that the US should have and must have their focus on Asia, on China.
They are. And this, again, reflects that strategic distance between the two countries rather than the similarity that's often actually pointed out. We see on the one hand a very clear vision of systemic competition that is there, and on the other, an attempt to salvage what you can from the flat world of globalization by clinging to multipolarity. And that, of course, would be the negative interpretation of strategic autonomy, that Europe would exist as that autonomous pole, regardless of values. And I think that's something that comes out very clearly from this conference, is something that people are really trying to avoid here, but the message hasn't necessarily penetrated every other, well, it's not penetrated all of the chancelleries of Europe, let's say. Let's put it in that sense.
Not only is China watching, the world is watching. And the world is watching us, who we've proclaimed to have the greatest military alliance in the history of the world, which I believe to be true, combined the population of more than a billion people, 440 million of us Europeans, in a fight that many of us have said is existential, like President Macron, Prime Minister Kaya Kallas, a fight for our future with a country that Senator John McCain famously described as nothing but a gas station with nukes, okay? Mm-hmm. We're in this struggle. It's been going on for 3 years, and it seems to be a draw at the moment. So when we look at how the world reacts, not only vis-a-vis the war in Ukraine, but vis-a-vis the West in general, and we see them sort of sitting on the fence, then that's the reason why. And there is no question, I don't think, in anybody's mind, that in the, I'm not even talking about the long term, in the midterm, Europe is going to be successful in countering Russia. The question is about the Russia challenge. You look down the 21st century, the list of challenges is huge. Russia is perhaps not the most significant one when you look at it from a sort of a historic perspective. We don't come across as definitive winners of this century. And that's our fault. Obviously, everything is interconnected. Our success in Ukraine will lead to a credibility with regard to other conflicts out there. So I think we need to be better at connecting those dots and pursuing a coherent strategy, not only in Europe, but obviously also globally.
And the historical anomaly of democracy's dominance came about by us really being the best we could be. We need to get back that winning mentality, don't we, Ben?
We need to get back that winning mentality. And I want to add something, because we talked about leadership and communicating a definition of victory. And I say this as a politician now elected in Paris. We should not forget that our public opinions are one of the fronts. And Putin is very aware of this. He's communicating his threats when he's talking about nuclear weapons. All of it. It's clearly about talking to our public opinions. And one thing that struck me when I was in DC in January, making the case with a few colleagues from the Baltic states and others, to representatives, Democrats or Republicans, making the case for unblocking the aid to Ukraine, is that some of the Republicans who were skeptical did make, I think, an argument that was reasonable. They said, President Biden has not articulated what our victory is, what our end game is, what we're going to use this money for. And I thought, as much as I wanted them to approve the aid, I thought, okay, this is not a crazy point. And it's really important that we do this. It's really important that we not only put it into the framework of what we've been saying, which is defending the existence of Europe, the European security architecture, but also phrasing it very concretely in terms of what impact it will have on everyday living, you know, on the ability of Russia to control the cost of food, the cost of energy, and how that would affect the purchasing power of the everyday French. And this is where I want to go back to what you both said early on. Yes, we should talk about the cost of defeat. Because the problem when we talk about everything that we've spent and done in the last 2 years to support Ukraine, and of course, sometimes it's at the expense of other things, one of the problems in politics is that you never have the counterfactual. You never have the price of inaction or the price of Russian victory and the concrete impact it would have on our societies. And I think that's something that when you talk about leadership, it's extremely important to be able to regularly articulate this to our public opinions.
Right. And that's exactly what the demand that seemed to come across from our focus group would suggest. But Sabina, last word to you. This is surely what the German government would need to do if there's to be a true Titan vendor worthy of the name, to articulate that vision clearly and a strategy for achieving it, not only as a lodestar for policymaking, but as a rallying point for the nation.
I agree with that. I wanted to focus on something different. I think it is important to understand that 2024 will be a very decisive year. I talked a lot at Leonard Mary conference with Moldovan colleagues. They are under massive permanent hybrid attack. If Russia advances, and we know that it's not going well in Ukraine at the moment for Ukraine, for reasons that have a lot to do with our own policies, if Russia advances along the Black Sea coast, Moldova will be under immediate threat again. Developments in Georgia are extremely worrying. I've been told by one person that Bidzina Ivanishvili, he's not an oligarch, he's a monarch. So the monarch of Georgia is actually gearing up to a, say, post-Russian victory scenario of regional development. And he saw this as one of the reasons for the turn the Georgian government has taken over the past months and probably, I mean, it's a trend, so several years. So I think 2024 will be very, very decisive, also with regard to our own states and societies. It's a super election year. So, I mean, I'm watching this. I'm concerned. I'm a little less optimistic than you are with regard to the prospects of success. So I think we really need to get our acts together. So, you know, don't despair, but act is the motto of this conference. And I think we should take it to heart.
Absolutely. That speaks to the urgency that we have in our democratic moment and in our strategic moment.
Thank you very much once again to our guests today, Benjamin Haddad, Jonathan Sevyov, and Sabina Fischer. Now, as we said earlier in the show, we did hear from Estonian Prime Minister Kaja Kallas herself, who, in addition to her panel appearances at the Leonard Meri Conference in Tallinn, spoke to international media during a briefing at Stenbock House, the Estonian government's official seat. So we get to finish up our last regular episode of this season, hearing from one of Europe's most impressive leaders, don't we, Ben?
We certainly do. And at the time of recording this special intro and the segues that we put between our different segments of this Berlin Side Out, it looks like Kaja Kallas is actually gaining a lot of support for a really top job in Brussels. Her name is very much in the mix for the position of HRVP, or the High Representative for the Common Foreign and Security Policy, and Vice President of the European Commission, which is widely considered one of the top three jobs. Why is her name in the running? Well, there are some sort of quota-based reasons. One is the party affiliation that she has, which is the Renew Europe or Liberal Party. And with Ursula von der Leyen likely to become Commission President again, and the names in the running for the Council President of Antonio Costa of Portugal,
from respectively the European People's Party, the centre-right, and the Socialists and Democrats, the centre-left. That leaves the Liberals needing a top job. So Kaja Kallas ticks that box. She also ticks the box of being from Central and Eastern Europe, which with von der Leyen, again, in pole position for the Commission President, coming from Western or Northern Western Europe, and Costa coming from Portugal in Southern Europe, leaves Central and Eastern Europe needing a top spot as well. And so she ticks that box. But let's be very clear. Kaja Kallas is not in the running because she ticks boxes. Kaja Kallas is in the running because of how impressive she has been as a leader, particularly over the last 2 years. And now she will have the chance, we hope, to show that leadership talent, to show those leadership skills on the top stage. And it would certainly be a massive step change from what we've seen from Josep Borrell in recent times, if Kallas can bring the kind of approach that she brought to being Prime Minister of Estonia into the being the position of High Representative. And she's certainly aware of the key challenges that we face. So let's turn to her now for our first answer in that press conference and hear from her about what the strategic priorities are for 2024 and how serious the challenge in Ukraine actually is.
I think 2024 is really a year of strategic defense. I think what I said yesterday, in 2023, we were maybe overly optimistic. I mean, everybody was talking about the counteroffensive and, you know, big disappointments come from big expectations. So I think we should avoid a mistake of being overly pessimistic in 2024. Yes, we need to be very honest and open about this. The support needs to get to Ukraine, sure, but fast. And we have to make sure that we do not create pessimism from pessimism. I mean, that, you know, this is all circling around. This would lead to inaction. It's like, okay, there's nothing to do there, you know, it's all going down, so we don't have to do anything. But I think this is wrong. We still have to believe in Ukraine's victory and also build our strategies around that. All the actions we do will follow that suit.
So Ben, Kallas encouraged us just there to keep believing in Ukraine's victory. But we also heard from Estonian Foreign Minister Marga Sakna on our Tallinn Side Out special with Timothy Snyder, Elliot Cohen, and Anna Isabel Xavier that we can't just believe, we have to act. But believing in victory first helps you figure out how to act, right? It is the first step.
Well, it does. For that, you have to understand why we need to win, why it's so absolutely crucial that Ukraine and indeed the whole of Europe wins a common victory, as Robin Wagner told us on our Pillars of Victory episode, in Ukraine, and that Russia is defeated there. So you have to understand that. But I'd actually also point to something Elliot Cohen said in that episode, where he talked about the psychologist William James and saying that you don't do brave things because you have brave feelings, but rather you get the brave feelings when you do brave things.
Right.
And when you commit to winning, that will make winners of us all. And that's the attitude I think we actually have to take.
So Prime Minister Kallas said something about this too, this action that you get from that attitude. So specifically what we as a collective West have to commit concretely to get to victory.
Our promise is to not save lives. The actual weapons in the hands of Ukrainian soldiers do. Actual air defense does. So that's why we need to really deliver. Sometimes I feel that, you know, many things are mixed up in the picture. The promises given to Ukraine, you know, long-term promises and actual deliverables. So if we put them all together, we can, you know, pat ourselves in the back and say that, oh, we have done a lot. But actually, when I hear, they all go through the NATO's bases in Poland, and they actually know what Ukraine is getting, and that is not the promises, the slogans, what we hear. So that is a real worry regarding this. Of course, our military aid to Ukraine has been over 500 million, and this amounts to more than 1.3% of our GDP. We have also agreed to allocate, you know, long-term support, 0.25% of our GDP to from 24 to 27 to Ukraine as military aid. And if all countries would do the same, then it would actually lead to Ukraine's victory.
So we've heard from the Prime Minister there about what we need to do, the acts that we need to take to bring about our strategic objectives. But Ben, as you've said before, often we're afraid of our own power to do that. Now, part of that is because the Russian narrative isn't questioned nearly enough in the West. It is a country with an economy that is smaller than Canada's, actually, but it occupies a big spot in our collective Western imagination, doesn't it?
It does. And this is a really interesting point, because this is where Russia's approach mirrors that of the populists in our own societies and the anti-democratic forces, which, you know, comes as no surprise. I mean, Russia has absolutely zero soft power. We're not going to see people moving en masse to Russia or suggesting that we really adopt the Russian model. Because when implied in practice, what that Russian model means too often is no inside toilets, rampant poverty, public drunkenness, poor health outcomes, domestic violence, and all sorts of other things that we've actually put largely into the past in our country. So it's like a step back in time. And if that's what you mean by traditional values, then, well, you're welcome to them. But certainly that's not where I would see Europe's future. And I don't think anyone sensible actually would. The point here is that Russia pretends to provide a very simple solution to all of the West's woes. And for sure, there are things we need to fix in our societies. There are things we need to get right. We need to give people that sense of a credible sense of a hopeful future that we've talked about many times on the show. But certainly adopting the Russian approach is absolutely not the way to go about that. But again, it's about providing a very simplistic and simple answer to what are in fact complex problems. So, you know, wouldn't it be nice if there were such a simple answer? Well, there isn't. And it's actually about doing the hard work to understand how we go about both fixing our problems, but also playing on those real strengths, which have included the tolerance and diversity that you mentioned in alluding to Gay Roper. We don't have to convince anyone of the merits of flat whites and lattes, I think, but at the same time, there are serious things that we actually need to fix. And one of the people who's been doing most thinking about that and how we actually put that in combination with resolute defense is Prime Minister Kallas.
Now, one journalist asked the Prime Minister about that Russian narrative, and you've just provided a very, one of my favorite refutations of it that I think I've ever heard. But somehow it still sticks in some people's minds in the West simply because they don't actually know very much about how ordinary Russians actually live, which you've also talked about just now. There is still this idea that Russia is a bastion of traditional values against the Gay Roper of a decadent West that we've talked about. So how should we address that narrative? Let's hear from the Prime Minister on this.
It's a very good book by Timothy Snyder, The Road to Unfreedom, that shows that when Russia can't become the West will become Russia, and how the narratives of the far right are actually meeting the narratives of Russia regarding Europe. This is that Europe is morally corrupt. That means all the gay marriages and all these things, you know, not the traditional family. And then Europe is under a migration pressure, and that migration pressure is Muslim migration mostly. So now they are actually creating the situation where, you know, it's not only narrative, but actually people see, you know, the migration pressure is there. They created from, Syria, bombing Syria back then, Wagner in Africa, so that, you know, where do the migrants go? They go to Europe. So actually, they are creating this, and also from Ukraine. They all come to Europe. And what our adversaries know is that migration is our vulnerability. And therefore, these two meet. Now, coming to the European elections, then all these parties, anti-migration, I think what we have to understand, I would say so, that Russia is weaponizing migration, our adversaries are weaponizing migration, but they are also weaponizing human rights, because they know that, you know, human rights are very important to European Union. So, I mean, they push the migrants over the border. They create the problems for European side because, they weaponize this, it's human rights. You have to accept those people. And that is, of course, water to the mill of the far right. The far right, at least in Estonia, and I've read from other parts of Europe as well, they are actually quite careful regarding Ukraine. So they are saying that, of course, we support Ukraine, but we have done enough. So it is not so direct that they are against Ukraine or supporting Ukraine. So they don't go very directly, but they do this, the narratives regarding Ukrainians in our societies and we have done enough. I mean, now our own people need support and let's draw the line and have that is gone. That is not our problem. So it is not as direct, but it's definitely going to have an effect because the populists are always coming up with simple solutions to very complex problems.
One example of how Russian narratives can penetrate our society comes up whenever we hear arguments that NATO expansion provoked Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Now, Prime Minister Kallas was asked about countering this narrative, and she amusingly called it my favorite topic.
My favorite topic. I have to tell you a story for this. And sorry, but it's also related to a book. So it's a very good book, Mary Sarati, Not One Inch. Where did this idea come that, Russia was promised that NATO is not enlarging? And it's a very good book. Very good historical, very good work done and very well written and everything. And so I'm in France. I have my birthday weekend. I get this book. I'm reading this book on the beach. And there's an American couple beside me. And they ask, is it a good book? I said, oh, it's so good book. And then we go back to Estonia. I am in airport or traveling back to Estonia and I'm reaching the conclusion of this book. And I was like, how can she, come to such a conclusion based on such good work that she has done? So basically that we should have offered Russia something, they have legitimate security interest or whatever. Why I'm telling this is that then I said that I thought that, oh my God, I recommended this book to the Americans and now they're thinking that, we should offer something to Russia. But then I said to Munich Security Conference, Christoph Oisken, I said that, can you invite her? I really want to debate her on the conclusion. And he said, fine. And we had this debate there regarding this, whether it was promised or not. And whether there should be something offered to them. By the way, she also told that she's a historian working in a university and she gets a call from Jens Stoltenberg's office and they say that, Jens Stoltenberg wants to have a dinner with you because Kaja Kallas recommended your book. And he has read the book and he wants to discuss this. It's like, okay, I get the dinner 2 hours with Jens Stoltenberg because you recommended the book. But anyway, so I think there are a lot of good arguments. One is that what I say in the Global South is that every country has the right to choose their defense alliances. I mean, believe me, read this book and you can understand they didn't want us in NATO. We worked so hard to get into NATO. So it wasn't that NATO wants to expand. No, we wanted to get in because we have a neighbor like this. Because we are in NATO, we don't have a war like Ukraine has because we are under NATO's umbrella. It is not about, NATO is not it's not threatening Russia. Not a single European or NATO country is threatening Russia. I mean, not Latvians, not us. We are not declaring war on Russia. No, definitely not. So we are not presenting any threats. So what are they afraid of? I mean, these are the things, and I think what mostly works is that that it was our wish. We work so hard. We are able to really confront this narrative, but it keeps on popping up.
And this is such an important point that Prime Minister Kallas made there, talking about the very real struggle that actually Central and Eastern European states had in order to convince the existing NATO states at the time that they belonged in that exclusive alliance. Well, they've really shown the value of having them in. They've shown they not only belong, but can lead the way, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently said. And frankly, they're setting an example for a lot of the rest of the alliance and will be at the heart and hopefully at the head of the European pillar that NATO truly needs if it's actually going to not only survive, but thrive going forward. Now, there's another very important aspect of this, which is about self-determination, of course. And this is the difference between a sphere of influence, as empires like Russia would seek to have, and a sphere of integration, where countries can collectively determine which alliances they would like to try and be part of. Now, of course, they have to convince the others, but they have the right themselves to try and understand for themselves which alliances to join. Now, of course, this is a key point that relates also to colonialism and histories of empire. And we know that doesn't only pertain in Europe, of course, it pertains all around the world. And it's a particularly big question when we talk about relations with the global south, which is why I think it would be extremely interesting if Prime Minister Kallas were to be appointed as High Representative for the Common Foreign and Security Policy. She would have a point of difference coming from a small country or smaller country. And remember, it's the size of the fight in the dog, not the dog in the fight that counts in a lot of these things. But coming from a smaller country that was indeed colonized and occupied, rather than coming from a former imperial nation, she would have a different point from which to launch off discussions with the global south. So let's hear what she had to say about that issue.
I think we have a very good position, and that is that we have never colonized anybody. We don't have that as small countries. So we are not suspected of really pushing forward our own interests when we talk about these struggles. And I think that is our strength, what we have to use, especially with the global south and countries all around the world to explain what is at stake here. Russia is working hard also to convince the countries from other parts of the world to see the world how they are seeing this. We have to do the same.
So actually understanding this as a global struggle, one in which we all have interests at stake, or at least certainly those who would wish to live in a democratic and free future, wherever they reside, be that in the north, the south, the east, or the west, that's part of the key challenge that the new HRVP will actually have. And one point that really stood out to me, Aaron, when we were in Tallinn, was Kaja Kallas echoing the words of the historian Timothy Snyder in saying that we have to treat these different incidents of democracies under attack, of authoritarian aggression, not as individual isolated cases, but as part of a wider connected phenomenon. Now, of course, that doesn't mean these things are all done in coordination or they're all done in through some kind of conspiratorial mechanism. But what they have in common is that they put democracy under threat and they put freedom under threat. And so we need to present a clear, strong, and united front against them. And one of the most hot aspects of that front right now, of course, is in Ukraine.
Exactly, Ben. And we've made the case before here that Russia is already at war with us, not simply at war with Ukraine, but actually with all of us. Ukraine is simply the flashpoint right now of that systemic struggle between an authoritarian Russia and a democratic West. That's something that our Estonian hosts in Tallinn certainly understand, something that the Prime Minister certainly makes a point of continuing to stress. Here's what she had to say about this.
What is important to understand is that, there are different tensions building up all across the world. And Azerbaijan, Armenia, for example, Middle East, South China Sea. In 1938, I think a mistake was made to treat all these kind of, you know, Italian invasion in Abyssinia, the German occupation and you know, all these things, Japan war, to treat them as isolated events. And I think we shouldn't do that now. So if you are not afraid of, you know, the war reaching your country, then the overall peace of the world in different parts should concern us all. Ukrainian defeat is definitely something that all the aggressors would learn from, that this pays off. You can just, in 2024 or 22, you can just bluntly go and colonize part of another country and nothing happens to you. So you can do it.
So we are in a systemic competition. The Prime Minister made that point very clearly here. But if we're going to win this competition, we need to be able to back it up with the necessary resources, not simply to help Ukraine win, but to step up our own deterrence, to step up our own ability to be able to handle the geostrategic challenges of the future, which also are in the Indo-Pacific as well. Prime Minister Kallas laid out the measures she thinks Europe in particular should consider to get from, as you often say, Ben, from should to did, how we actually build that capacity.
I also hope that other countries will follow suit, because I think in European level, using the proceeds is already a good thing, first step. But eventually, all countries will come to the place where the taxpayers will say that, you know, why should we pay for this? We haven't caused the damages in Ukraine. And this is a very, very accurate question. So I think we will get there eventually. Of course, on our own defense, we have to strengthen the European defense and boost our defense industry. There, the big gap is capital, access to capital regarding, you know, boosting defense. Good to see that the trajectory is going higher, and it reached 360 billion defense spending of countries last year. Euros, then it was 360 billion euros last year. This is the level not seen since the Cold War, but it's still not enough. I mean, only 18 countries are reaching 2% this year, and in 23 it was 11%, but still it's not 32 countries of NATO. Of course, closing the existing gaps in our security and defense, that also means boosting the defense industry. And there, of course, it is, we have proposed the Eurobonds. We are pushing this forward. France is supporting, and we have some other countries also on board. We have some countries who are very much against this, but we have done this when we really understand that we are in crisis. I mean, in terms of COVID, everybody understood that, you know, we have to act fast, so we raise capital together. And I think, you know, this illustrates that not only all countries understand that we are in this crisis now, and we have to act now, but we are working on that. We also did the defense investment fund in order to put the seed money into the defense industry, so that to open up the capital of private funds as well. I also need to point out the shadow war that is going on against our society. So Russia is really wanting to sow fear in our societies, and also make us refrain from supporting Ukraine. We see different hybrid types of attacks in different parts of the European Union. I think it would be a mistake to treat them in isolation. For example, one intelligence office, they were telling that we are saying to another member state that, you know, we see that GRU, you know, Russians are, they have plans to attack your warehouse. And then when there is a fire in that warehouse, then the other country says that, oh, we are going to invest the fire and we don't know it's Russians. Although the intelligence told them 2 weeks before that the Russians want to attack this warehouse. So the point being that I feel that there is this innate understanding or hope that it's not Russians. I think if we are treating these in isolation, then we don't understand how serious the situation really is.
And Aaron, I'm sure you were as glad as I to see that, in fact, since Prime Minister Kallas spoke, the number of countries meeting that 2% target has, in fact, risen. The NATO figures that have been announced ahead of the Washington summit show that now 20 of the alliance members are meeting that target. But don't forget, that target is a floor, not a ceiling. And it also depends what you get for your money there that will determine the capabilities, which really actually are what we need to be focusing on. 2% is good political shorthand. 2.5% would be better. And I think we can expect to see an increase in that floor at some point in the next couple of years, perhaps even already from the Washington summit. Let's see. But it depends on those capabilities that we need. And that's where the EU has to get its act together and work together with NATO in order to help boost the defense industrial base in Europe and to make sure that we're procuring the strategic enablers, the strategic strike capability, the military mobility assets that we need in order to actually be able to bear the bulk of conventional deterrence responsibility in Europe ourselves. Now, that's something that it wouldn't matter whether Donald Trump were elected again, or Joe Biden gets a second term. It's something that would be welcomed across the board in Washington. And frankly, I think it's the only thing that will actually really keep NATO together in the long term, is if we see that real burden shifting, the creation of a true European pillar of NATO. And unsurprisingly, Kaja Kallas was also rather clear about that.
We are not voting in American elections, so we have to work with every leader that the Americans are choosing for themselves. Last time when Trump was president, then all the allies actually invested more in defense. That was a good thing on the European level. But I think we shouldn't be worrying about, you know, leaders of different countries, but thinking what we can do ourselves as Europe, despite of who's the president of the United States. And that means that we have to invest more in our defense, everybody, all the allies who have also had the defense investment pledge. And we have to boost our defense industry. We have to make sure that all these things are interoperable, that we do the exercises together and all these things that we are trying to do here, that we would actually be able to defend NATO, here if the threat is here.
And so talking about then the possibility of a Donald Trump victory or indeed a Joe Biden victory brings us to thinking about how we need to actually fix our own roof in order to make sure that we have the democracies that are worth defending, that live up to their promise at home to our citizens, that enough of our people are actually satisfied with our system to buy into it and to therefore create the truly resilient societies that we will need to win this systemic competition. And this is something that was very much understood during the Cold War. It was something that leaders around Europe and the US, even Richard Nixon understood this, interestingly. Addressing a group of NATO leaders in 1973, he talked about the welfare state and the importance of the welfare state and social housing provision and so on. Because what Nixon and also every other leader, I think, in that NATO grouping realized was that our systemic competition, our war, is on two fronts. One is international, and for that we need the diplomatic, military, and security means, as well as the right attitude, in order to win it. But we have to win it at home as well. And we have to head off the threats to our democracy at home. And that means really giving our people that credible sense of a better future. It means increasing political participation, and perhaps a different political economic model too. And that's all things that we are going to be talking about on the small little PS to season two of Berlin Side Out that we've got planned for next week, isn't it, Aaron?
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. And we will also have much more details on what's next for Berlin Side Out, as well as for us and our work on how we get to that strategic capacity building, how we actually achieve those objectives necessary to be able to secure our societies, but also ensure that, as we've often said on this podcast before, our societies remain worth defending, that they are prosperous societies, that they are open societies, that they really, that we also win on that second front that you've been talking about, Ben, not simply the military, but also the societal.
So that's all for this special bonus edition of Berlin Side Out, partly recorded in Tallinn. Thanks very much indeed to all of our guests who were joining us at the Lennart Meri Conference, which was a terrific conference. And congratulations to Helga Kalm and the organizing team from ICDS there in Tallinn, who made it such a an intellectually stimulating as well as a very enjoyable experience for us all. Thank you very much indeed to Estonian Prime Minister Kaja Kallas for her time when she was speaking with the international media, including us at Berlin Side Out. Thank you to our project assistant, Julian Stöckle, our technical producer, Hendrik Werner, and the DGAP team who made Berlin Side Out Season 2 possible. And stay tuned for some exciting news about our third season, as well as details about the Democratic Strategy Initiative, which will look at how we get from reactive site and vendor to proactive strategy that marshals our resources to win the systemic competition. You can find links in our show notes, links to our guests and to some readings. But for now, though, auf Wiedersehen and tschüss.